Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you for joining us today for this NACo member update on COVID-19. My name is Marianne Borgeson. I serve as a Douglas County Commissioner here in Douglas County, Nebraska, and I serve as NACo, the National Association of Counties President. The purpose of today's call is to provide you with the latest CDC information on the coronavirus, including updates on testing, vaccine development, and preventative measures to stop the spread. I again want to take time to thank our first responders, our medical personnel, our public health staff, and all of you as county leaders and you all on the phone from CDC. Counties are the front lines. We say that over and over, but we are proving that it is so, so important during this pandemic, as well as the partnerships being key to achieving our public health goals. And again, this is even more important during this COVID-19 pandemic. We are pleased to be joined on the call today by one of our strongest partners, the Centers of Disease Control and Prevention. Following their remarks, we will take a few questions, so please submit your questions by email to research@naco.org. Again, if you have any questions following the CDC's remarks, please email those to research@naco.org. At this time, I'd like to welcome Dr. Henry Walk, Director of the Division of Preparedness and Emerging Infections at the CDC. Dr. Walk, I thank you so very much for joining us today, and the floor is yours.
Well, Ed, thank you so much for the introduction, and thank you for allowing me to speak today on behalf of the CDC response. My name is Henry Walk, and I serve as the Deputy Incident Manager for a jurisdictional support structure within CDC's COVID-19 response. We also have several subject matter experts here on the line, Aaron Hall from our Epidemiology Task Force, Ryan Fagan from our Medical Countermeasures and Task Force, as well as Jonathan Yoder from our community mitigation group. So we look forward to answering your questions on this call. So as you're aware, local and county level activities and strategies are key to controlling the spread of COVID-19. CDC recently established a new structure within the response to actively support state, local, tribal, and territorial health agencies. We've had a structure of the State Coordination Task Force for throughout the response, but we added additional people to ensure that we can meet your needs. We appointed jurisdictional liaison officers to serve as a centralized COVID-19 point of contact for all jurisdictions. And they'll coordinate across all of our task forces here at CDC for any technical assistance needs, as well as coordinating with the regional ASPR and FEMA contacts. As you all know, this is a whole-of-government approach. FEMA has activated the National Response Coordinating Center, the NRCC, to coordinate this government-wide effort. CDC and other HHS agencies are part of this larger NRCC structure. CDC leadership and the SMEs are subject matter experts deployed. We had subject matter experts deployed to Washington, D.C. to work closely with our federal partners across the NRCC. Actually, Dan Jernigan is a part of the Unified Command, who was our former incident manager here in CDC in Atlanta, but now has moved up to D.C. So we have an active voice in what's happening within this Unified Command. CDC is leading the community mitigation and surveillance efforts within the NRCC, as well as deeply engaged in health systems, medical countermeasures, and diagnostic issues. Let me move on to a situational update of where we are now in the current outbreak. As of today, March 30th, there's over 142,000 confirmed and presumptive cases, with over 18,000 new cases reported in the past day, and 2,400 deaths across the U.S. with reported cases in all 50 states, D.C., Puerto Rico, Guam, CNMI and the U.S. Virgin Islands. Globally, there are now reported 634,000 cases with 29,000 cases, deaths, I'm sorry, 29,000 deaths reported by WHO. The number of cases of COVID-19 being reported in the U.S. is rising very quickly. And this increase was expected given an increase in testing and ongoing rapid spread of disease across the communities in the United States. We're clearly seeing some hot spots across the nation, which many of you have probably seen in the media. New York, including New York City, New Jersey, California, Michigan, but other communities are also seeing increases in cases, for example, in Louisiana, and we expect this to continue. New York, excluding New York City, has reported over 25,000 cases, and New York City has reported over 33,000 cases. Currently, CDC has issued a travel advisory for three states, New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut, and this is on our website. In addition, you may have seen that long-term care facilities continue to be a priority for many jurisdictions with multiple outbreaks in multiple states. CDC is working closely with those on the ground to provide technical assistance either through virtual assistance from CDC Atlanta, but we also have a number of programmatic staff in jurisdictions, as well as we're sending field teams to help out. These teams are providing guidance for infection prevention and control to limit spread of disease and to protect healthcare workers as well as residents in these long-term care facilities. We continually monitor new data to inform our understanding of how the disease is spreading, those who are most at risk, and then try to translate that data into action. In terms of those who are at risk, based on current data, people who are at higher risk for severe illness include people who are aged 65 years or older, people who live in a nursing home or long-term care facility, people with serious underlying health conditions, such as chronic lung disease, serious heart conditions, are immunocompromised, including those who are receiving cancer treatment, or severe obesity, are also more likely to develop serious outcomes. We CDC, continue to support expanded testing to support our surveillance needs. As of March 30th, 94 state and local public health labs in 50 states, the District of Columbia, Guam, and Puerto Rico, verified they are successfully using COVID-19 diagnostic tests. CDC local, state, and public health laboratories have tested now over a total of 128,000 specimens. In addition, and importantly, private laboratories are increasing their testing capacity. The Food and Drug Administration has issued a number of emergency use authorizations for commercial manufacturers to develop other COVID-19 tests. These tests include a point-of-care test that can deliver results in as few as 15 minutes, which was announced on Friday by Abbott. We are continuing to support community mitigation strategies and provide clear guidance. In the White House briefing Sunday night, President Trump announced the social distancing guidelines in the 15 days to slow the spread initiative announced on March 16th will be extended through April 30th. These guidelines are to help protect Americans during the coronavirus pandemic. The initiative lays out guidelines for a nationwide effort, to reduce disease transmission, to protect those at highest risk for severe outcome, to protect the ability of the healthcare sector to respond, and to interrupt clusters of disease. In support of these efforts, CDC has published guidance to help local communities make informed decisions about how to contain and limit the spread of disease. CDC will modify these documents and are constantly updating these documents to reflect the extended timeline. Highlights include guidance for clinicians in healthcare settings, such as long-term care facilities, as well as community settings, like schools, correctional facilities, and faith-based organizations. We know county and local government officials and health departments play a very critical role in controlling the spread of the disease, and we will continue to make decisions to protect your communities based on local conditions. Please help make connections within your community to your local health agencies as concerns and needs arise. CDC is committed to supporting your local health agencies and connecting them with state and federal partners. We're also here to provide direct technical assistance, guidance, and resources to address your public health needs. We'll continue to adapt to evolving conditions at the national, state, and county level and to best combat the outbreak and spread. We know that this is a difficult time for local jurisdictions and communities and the population in the U.S., and so let's hopefully stand together to try to pull together our collective resources and continue to work to stop this outbreak. We look forward to working with you and collaborating with you in the future. So that's a general overview of where we are and some of our activities. I want to thank you for, again, letting me be on the call today. I'm happy to answer questions that you may have, as well as our subject matter experts we have on the line. So once again, thank you.
Thank you so much, Dr. Walk. This is Blair Bryant from NACO, and just a reminder to all of our participants on the call, if you have a question, then please submit it to research@naco.org. So I will begin with reading a few questions we've already received. So first, I know you mentioned, Dr. Walk, that private labs were doing testing. Is there more information you can provide to us on how they're reporting to the CDC test results, and if they're sharing that information with local health departments?
Thank you for the question. There are a number of private laboratories that are testing, and CDC is working with these laboratories like LabCorp, Quest, for example, to receive those streams of information de-identified to better understand the prevalence of the disease in the community. In terms of reporting the results back to the actual health departments, I think that very much depends on the jurisdiction itself and local and state laws. But I would ask our other subject matter experts on the line to respond if they'd like to respond with more information.
Yeah. Hi, Henry. This is Aaron Hall. Maybe I could just add a few brief comments to that question. So first, we do have some systems that are managed by CDC in close collaboration with the state partners to track testing that takes place in private laboratories. These, as Henry pointed out, are de-identified systems, so there's no patient-level information, but they generally provide kind of aggregate counts of how many tests were performed and how many were positive, which can still be very useful for decision-making at kind of the community or state level. We are also aware of processes led by the Council of State and Territorial Epidemiologists to establish standard case definitions and reporting requirements within jurisdictions. And so, as alluded to, these will, of course, vary from state to state as that gets adopted into state laws and regulations and rules. But there are efforts to unify that approach across the nation, standardize case definition and any elements of data that will be collected on those cases. So essentially, I think CDC's role is exactly as outlined, trying to inform and lay out kind of a framework for standardizing of data, including from clinical labs, but much of that reporting is going to depend on state and local requirements. Over.
Thank you so much. Next question is, can you all provide an update on vaccine development?
Yeah, this is Henry. There are a number of vaccine candidates in the pipeline. And if you've been watching Tony Fauci from NIAID or NIH on the news, repeatedly been said, we don't expect a vaccine basically to become available for another 12 to 18 months. There are several candidates that are being investigated both in the U.S. and throughout the world, and first we have to evaluate the safety of these particular candidates, and then we need to evaluate how effective they are. So there are multiple candidates, but it'll be at least a year to 18 months really before we'll have a vaccine that could be used in the population.
Thank you for that. Can you all provide an update on the risk of morbidity and mortality from the virus? I know you already mentioned who is most at risk, but is there specifications on who is at higher risk of dying from the virus?
Right. I did sort of read out the people who are at highest risk, and we are seeing increased hospitalization and mortality among those high-risk groups, which are people who are greater than 65 years or older, those who live in nursing homes, long-term care facilities, and as well who have high-risk conditions, for example, chronic lung disease, heart disease with complications, those who are immunocompromised, or people of any age, actually, with severe obesity. There will be, up and coming, more information published, including MMWR, looking at these high-risk conditions. But Aaron, did you want to add anything else or anyone else on the line?
Yeah, thanks, Henry. Just briefly, as you mentioned, we do have a report that will be coming out tomorrow in the MMWR that will provide an initial preliminary description of data received so far on these underlying conditions among reported cases and their relative proportions among hospitalized and non-hospitalized patients. So this will be a bit of a first pass at those high-risk groups, and there are many efforts underway to dive much more deeply into this, better characterize the conditions that put people at higher risk in a more granular manner so that we can more effectively target prevention efforts to those folks.
Thank you. So we're getting a number of questions on CDC-related guidance, so I'll start reading some of those. With every state, county, and city being given the liberty to issue a shelter-in-place, the CDC intends to give guidelines to make these decisions more widely as it pertains to public health.
Jonathan, could you start with that?
Yes, this is Jonathan Yoder, and I think just taking a step back on that, when we talk about guidelines for community mitigation, what we're actually talking about is, those set of measures that people and communities take to help slow the spread of the virus. And so those community interventions, we generally think of them in three different categories. There are the personal actions that people take, those measures such as voluntarily home isolating when you're ill, voluntary home quarantine of exposed household members, covering your cough, washing your hands, and potentially, also using hand sanitizer and cleaning surfaces. So those are personal actions. There are also those community measures, which I think is what you're getting at, which are those community measures aimed at increasing social distance, those things like school closures, social distances in workplaces and other community settings, and then postponing or canceling mass gatherings. And then I guess the third category, which is those environmental measures such as cleaning so that any surfaces that are contaminated, the virus is no longer there. But that category of those increased social community measures, certainly CDC has looked at the data on the effectiveness of them, and we do think they are certainly effective, but as to the degree that they are implemented in communities and for the length of time, that certainly is in some ways either a state level or community level decision, even though CDC has broad national guidance on some of those measures.
Thank you. Thank you. So following up with another question on guidelines, will CDC issue streamlined regulation for the approval of locally made surgical masks?
This is Jonathan. I'll take a stab at that question around surgical masks, and I think the answer is if you're talking about for use in healthcare, I won't cover that piece, and maybe Ryan will cover that. But I think there is discussion of some of the areas where we know there's emerging evidence that you to prevent spread to someone else, a person may wear a mask, and that may be a person who's ill, which we recommend, or it could be a person who's infected, and we know they're infected, but they're asymptomatic. But that's for the purpose of protecting others from becoming infected. But if the question is around face mask or surgical mask used in healthcare facilities, I'll let Ryan handle that question.
Yes. Thank you, Jonathan. So I think, as Jonathan's getting at, we should differentiate between masks that are intended for use in healthcare and masks that are intended for use in the general community. On the healthcare side, it's actually FDA that regulates the manufacture of surgical face masks, and they have been in the process of issuing a number of emergency use authorizations for additional manufacturers and other products to be included in the supply chain to healthcare. So the intent there is to serve as personal protective equipment, and I wouldn't characterize as those necessarily as locally, homemade products. I think what the question might have been about and what Jonathan's talking about is, a lot of the textile, cotton, or locally sourced type masks that, as he indicates, are really not to be labeled as personal protective equipment appropriate for use in healthcare if the intent is to protect the wearer from respiratory inhalation. It's really more about containing your own secretions if you wear something like that. We don't have evidence to say the extent to how much that works, but there is a pretty good rationale for that. And, I think a simple way to understand that would be, my mask protects you and your mask protects me is a way to look at that from a source control perspective.
Thank you so much. Switching gears to testing, got a few questions on whether or not CDC intends to release guidelines or feels it would be beneficial to expand testing.
Yeah, maybe
so beyond the specified populations.
Mm-hmm. Maybe I'll start with that and then others can add. There are a number of of commercial tests that are now becoming available. CDC is supporting the public health laboratories with their testing currently, and we continue to provide both testing here at CDC as well as support for public health laboratories to test. There have been a number of universities and other laboratories who have worked closely with FDA to produce a test that actually could be used to diagnose the disease. And there are, as you've seen recently, as I mentioned, there's a new rapid test that are coming on board. So this is a emerging field. There were some initial issues with getting the testing, getting a testing availability, but that's rapidly becoming, testing is becoming more and more available. Not only to detect if they're actually, if you're currently infected, but we're also trying to work with jurisdictions, state, locals, and counties to work on some surveillance methods or serial surveys, we would say, to look and see if someone's been infected in the past. And this is extremely important as we try to determine what the spread of this virus has been in our communities. And will give us some indication on potentially how effective some of these different community mitigation efforts are how effective they are and how effective that they will be in the future. So this is a very rapidly evolving area related to testing, and CDC is primarily supporting the public health laboratories, and there's intense effort, as you saw, the number of tests are being done on the commercial side. But anyone else on the phone wants to contribute to that? Okay, I think we'll move on to our next question then.
Thank you. A few questions on the availability of test results. Where can people go to locate information on tests? Is it posted anywhere? I know HIPAA regulations prevent specific information being shared, but where can people go if they're looking for information?
Is this, just to clarify, is this for individual tests or sort of population testing? I'm a little confused.
Population-wide. So if a county, does a county post the number of positive test results, or is it posted by state or city, et cetera?
I think it's a mix of that. Aaron, could you comment?
Yeah, I'm sorry, can you elaborate a bit further for me first?
Sure. So is there a specific website that members can go to see the number of positive tests in their county? Is there a way you guys are tracking that at the national level?
Yes. So on county data specifically, we do not post those information publicly. But we are tracking information on testing at a national level and at a state level, both the number of tests performed, as I alluded to earlier, and the proportion positive. Not individual test results. CDC doesn't, as a general rule, receive, you know, individually identifiable information, but from kind of a population level to assess how much testing is taking place, what the relative percent positivity is, looking at it by different age groups to see if different populations are more affected than others. And those data are tracked through a couple of different systems, and we are working on a weekly report that will be publicly available and will include some interactive features that will allow folks to go and look at these data. And this will include so-called virologic data on testing results, but also data on disease and mortality that we'll be updating weekly. And this is for folks that are aware of the information that we put out about flu, influenza during the season. We have this weekly flu view report. We will essentially be generating a very similar type of report called COVID view. And we're hoping to debut that as early as next week. So hopefully that will be a useful resource for these kinds of inquiries.
Thank you. So the next question is on rapid testing. Is this going to be made more available, or do you have any more insight on when this will become available?
I don't have I don't have a lot of insight in terms of the distribution of this rapid test. I would anticipate that, the company or there's a number of different rapid tests actually, but there's one that has people that has media that's hit the media recently in terms of the Abbott tests of being able to get a result less than 15 minutes. So our anticipation is they will ramp up production. And then it will be available, through the company itself. But I really don't have a lot of information in terms of how quickly their production will escalate.
Thank you. Got a question about guidelines for farmers markets. Some farmers markets are considered essential services and staying open. Are there guidelines to prevent spread in markets such as that?
This is Jonathan, and again, this is, you know, it's not a lot of detail in that question, and I assume that there are a lot of variations in the type of farmer's market. You know, the space that would be available, is it an outdoor market versus an indoor market? Are you able to maintain, you know, 6 feet of distance between shoppers, and are there, you know, you able to clean surfaces that need to be cleaned? So I think there'd be a lot of things to keep in mind. You know, obviously people need food and need to be able to shop safely. So as a farmer's market able to adapt? Are they able to even spread out more so that there's, you know, not, you're not closely packed in? Are you able to maintain distance between shoppers? Those would all be things that I think are really important for that type of business to stay open. And again, there's no evidence that food is a source of transmission for the virus, but I think the concern would be around the person-to-person spread in any type of setting such as a shopping environment. I'm glad if others want to weigh in on that as well.
Yeah, this is Aaron. The only thing I might add is that I do know that some of our other sister agencies at the federal level have put out some general information about COVID and potential questions related to food and food service and food markets. And, I think the bottom line is, as much as Jonathan just highlighted, of course, kind of local conditions need to be considered, but, you know, that kind of routine food safety practices, you know, including hand hygiene and staying away while ill and routine disinfection, are thought to be largely protective against many of the potential risks that might be posed by COVID with food. And, you know, we do primarily think about this in terms of transmission in a respiratory form. And while contaminated surfaces are a potential avenue, the virus itself is not particularly stable in the environment and relatively susceptible to those typical food safety and food hygiene practices. So I'd encourage folks to take a look at the FDA website for some more specific information about questions around food and COVID.
Thank you, Aaron. And then I guess the one other part of that question that I forgot was the kind of critical infrastructure or critical decision. Again, that is that there are some guidance that from Department of Homeland Security, but then that certainly would be operationalized at the state or local level, depending on what's needed to keep your community safely operating. Thank you.
Thank you. A few questions regarding the timeline for quarantine measures. Is there a time frame that CDC is looking at where individuals will be safe to be about in the public and we can remove shelter in place and quarantine restrictions?
Yeah. Hi, this is Henry. I just got pulled away for something urgent. Can someone else on the line handle this, please?
And this is John. Can I ask a clarifying part of that? Is this, when you say quarantine, are you talking about an individual who has COVID and is ill and needs to isolate, or are you talking about someone who needs to quarantine because they've been exposed to someone who's ill and they may or they need to monitor symptoms or stay away until they determine whether they have the illness?
No, I think that was a misnomer. We're referring more to stay-at-home orders and shelter in place.
Great. So the question is how long will they be needed?
Yes.
Okay, meaning how many more weeks or months or will we be looking at this type of these type of orders or guidance? And again, I wish I had the answer for this. I know this is a very challenging situation, and as was mentioned earlier, you all are on the front lines of this. Your communities are both dealing with the health impact of of COVID, but also the tremendous disruption to your lives and business because of this. And so this is a really challenging situation, and I don't know that the same answer will apply everywhere. And I think this is where we where Henry mentioned earlier that we really are trying to get data on the number of cases and whether they're increasing or decreasing, the ability of your healthcare system to manage the patients that become ill, so that whether that you can operate, that the communities can operate safely. But I think there are some challenges in the short term with communities. If the health system is being overwhelmed, if there's widespread community spread, that there will be continued a need to continue some of these community mitigation measures. So I don't have an answer on how long that will be, and it will likely vary from place to place. Others, please add to that as you see fit.
Yeah, Jonathan, this is Ryan. I think, just to add, that we're very much still on the steep upswing of this in a lot of areas, and there's a lot of uncertainty about how long that's going to last and when we'll sort of be on the other side of it. So I totally agree that, really just more is going to be forthcoming on this as we see what happens. And also to underscore that, CDC certainly has authorities, but a lot of this is determined by the state and local jurisdictional level based on their current situations. Over.
Thank you. So we're going to do one more question, and this is kind of a two-part question. A number of questions came in about patients who recover and whether or not they have immunity to contracting the virus again. And then secondly is, what are we doing with the antibodies that these individuals produce? Is there something in the works with utilizing those antibodies for vaccine or treatment?
Yeah, this is Henry again, and others can jump in. But in terms of the issue of being reinfected, we can't never say never, but we're not seeing evidence of this with hundreds of thousands of people who are infected. But this is an area that we're still exploring. But it doesn't appear at the moment that people can reinfect it. But again, I think we're still learning about this virus as it unfolds. So I think that's where we are. The second question was.
The second question is, are the antibodies that individuals who have recovered being used for research on vaccine or treatment?
There's certainly been reports on this in other countries, and I'm not really, maybe Ryan or someone else has a bit more information than I do, but I don't know. Go ahead, Ryan, please.
Oh, yeah, I don't have data on the effectiveness of it, but I wanted to highlight that the FDA does have an investigational emergency protocol for that, and that would be requested through a provider taking care of a COVID patient. So there is a protocol for obtaining that in the United States, and a lot more to learn about its effectiveness.
Thank you so much, and thank you to all of our participants from the CDC for being on the call today and taking our questions. So at this time, we're going to go ahead and end the call, but before I let everyone go, I'll just remind you to check out www.naco.org/coronavirus for more resources, and we will be making this call available in a recap memo with a recording. Thank you, everyone, for attending, and have a good afternoon.